The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
GEICO presents unhelpful home improvement how-tos.
Overhanging trees present a real danger. During high winds, falling branches can damage roofs and windows. So today, I'll show you how to protect your home by wrapping it in bubble packaging. All you need is a staple gun and 142,000 feet of bubble packaging. Let's get started.
You could try to protect your home with bubble packaging, or you could get covered for personal property damage through the GEICO Insurance Agency. Call GEICO and see how affordable homeowners insurance can be.
This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup, a special broadcast reminding you of the big stories in 2017 and analyzing how they impact you. I'm Steve Dorsey in Washington. You'll hear our team of CBS News correspondents and analysts all over the world. It was undoubtedly a big year of news, but let's start with President Trump's nearly year in office. Our correspondent, Stephen Portnoy, is chronicling the year's wild ride at the White House.
Hi, Donald John Trump.
The crowd stretched as far as the new president could see.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period.
But from the sky, it was clear Barack Obama's inaugural crowds were bigger. A week into his presidency, protests erupted at airports as Mr. Trump signed an order blocking immigrants from seven majority Muslim countries.
When we use words like travel ban, that misrepresents what it is.
Critics called it a Muslim ban.
The president's powers here are beyond question.
The Supreme Court signaled it might agree with aide Stephen Miller. All year, the president battled the press.
Fake news. The press should be ashamed of themselves.
In February, Mr. Trump insisted.
This administration is running like a fine-tuned machine.
But his first year in office would be marked by internecine feuds and the firings of key staffers. National Security Advisor Michael Flynn was first to go, having misled Vice President Pence about his chats with Russians. President Trump tweeted his predecessor had Trump Tower wiretapped. But FBI Director James Comey told Congress,
I have no information that supports those tweets.
The president fired Comey in May. He said the Russia thing, the probe into election meddling, was on his mind. And he tweeted Comey had better hope there aren't any tapes of their conversations.
I've seen the tweet about tapes. Lordy, I hope there are tapes.
Comey told Congress he leaked memos of their chats to spark the appointment of a special counsel. Robert Mueller's probe has led to legal problems for Trump campaign aides and a guilty plea from former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. The West Wing wars were lampooned by the New York Post as a White House version of Survivor. Chief of Staff Reince Priebus was jettisoned in July. Retired General John Kelly was brought in to instill some discipline. In August, Steve Bannon departed, vowing to go to war with the GOP establishment.
Good afternoon.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders took over the press briefings from Sean Spicer. On Capitol Hill,
this is a disappointing day for us.
Obamacare repeal stalled before narrowly clearing the House. It died in the Senate. The death in August of a peaceful protester in Charlottesville, Virginia, who was demonstrating against a Confederate statue, prompted this response.
You had a group on the other side that was also very violent.
The president doubled down, saying the NFL should fire players who kneel during the national anthem. Some senior Republicans began to publicly break from Mr. Trump in the fall. Retiring Senator Bob Corker led the charge.
We could be heading towards World War III, kind of comments that he's making.
In September, Mr. Trump mocked North Korea's leader at the UN.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself.
In April, he launched airstrikes in Syria for Bashar al-Assad's use of chemical weapons. The president traveled this year to the Middle East, Europe, and Asia, seeking to solidify his own personal ties with world leaders and bolster U.S. manufacturing.
The stock market has gained trillions of dollars in value.
And he points to low unemployment and steady GDP growth as proof he's already making America great again. Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, The White House.
John Dickerson is host of Face the Nation. Let's talk to him about the year in politics. John, thanks for being here.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
As you know, a lot has changed in Washington. What do you think has been affected the most in this city?
The thing that's been affected the most in Washington is the playbook and the rule book. President Trump has changed the way politicians behave, changed the old-fashioned rules that were kept mostly by custom. And that goes to everything from the expectations of truth-telling on everything to the way he treats his opponents, sometimes being absolutely ruthless with people in his own party, then turning around and embracing them, and occasionally treating the Democrats that way, too. Basically, any rule you thought worked in Washington, you have to check it again to see if it still applies today.
The White House has accused what it calls the deep state of trying to undermine the president. Do you buy that?
Well, every president, and particularly Republican presidents, have complained about and had felt the constraints of the bureaucracy, which is what it used to be called, which is to say the lifetime or long-serving Washington dwellers who, in some instances, just like to do things the way they've always done things and so are resistant to the change of a new administration. In other cases, they know what they're talking about. They've been doing and working with these issues in the particular way in which it works in government. And in fact, at the end of the day, presidencies and administrations kind of learn to end up doing things the way they do. It's sort of inefficient. And then in the third way, there are holdovers from the previous administration who are alarmed by what President Trump is thinking of doing, what he might do, and those rules that he's been breaking in Washington. And they are fighting back. And then I guess finally, the final point about the way in which the permanent bureaucracy, the administrative state, revolts against a president is also the decision-making process. If it's sloppy, if it goes through not through the normal channels, you get people who feel like their views haven't been heard, and they tend to then create their own structures by talking to the press or speaking out. And that creates this feeling that there is a kind of permanent class that is working against the administration. In part, they do that in some cases because the administration hasn't sought their counsel. And so it really is connected to the way in which an administration works.
John, Hillary Clinton continues to be a favorite punching bag for President Trump. Does she have a future in politics, and will she always be a thorn in his side?
To the extent that Hillary Clinton is a thorn in the president's side, it's because he, on many days, wakes up, takes the thorn and sticks it into his side because he uses her effectively as a foil to keep his supporters engaged, inflamed. And she's not really doing anything because she lost and has no power that presents itself as an actual threat or even a rhetorical threat to the presidency. The to-do list for the president is quite long and full of robust challenges. If you had to number the challenges on a simply substantive scale for the president, Hillary Clinton probably wouldn't be in the top 75 or 100. But as a political tool, she's a very useful foil, and there really isn't a sufficient foil who gins up his political base as much as Hillary Clinton does. Chuck Schumer doesn't do it. Nancy Pelosi doesn't do it. So it's effective for him to keep the fight alive because it helps to align their supporters. If things get confusing, you can just point to the enemy. And so every presidency tries to do that. And in this case, President Trump is using a well-known villain in Republican circles to try to keep that conversation going for as long as he can, even if Hillary Clinton's not doing anything to actually add to it.
CBS News Face the Nation host John Dickerson on the year-end roundup. Thanks a lot, John.
Thanks, Steve.
Stay with us for a lot more. Our next subject's racial inequality, the Pentagon, and the Mideast on the CBS News year-end roundup. On the CBS News year-end roundup, a special program recapping 2017. I'm Steve Dorsey. Race and inequality took center stage in 2017. More from CBS News correspondent Bill Rakoff.
Oh, I wish I was a continental unfair.
A nation divided over race. In Charlottesville, Virginia, white supremacists rallied over a Confederate statue. Then, tragedy. A woman killed by a car driven by an alleged white nationalist.
Hallelujah.
In the wake of Charlottesville and Heather Heyer's death, dozens of Confederate symbols nationwide have come down.
I just hate seeing history destroyed.
Meanwhile, on campuses,
no Trump, no KKK, no
issues of race and free speech intermingled as protesters tried to stop right-wing speakers from taking to the stage.
Shut it down! Shut it down!
We don't tolerate that type of rhetoric.
Bill Rakoff, CBS News.
Of course, many NFL players also cast a spotlight on racial inequality. We'll have more on that in the second half of the year-end roundup. Let's turn to the Pentagon now.
Cammie McCormick is our national security correspondent at the Pentagon. Cammie, it's been a busy year at the Defense Department.
It sure has, beginning with a new Afghanistan strategy that was announced without many details by President Trump.
Our nation must seek an honorable and enduring outcome worthy of the tremendous sacrifices that have been made, especially the sacrifices of lives.
We know 3,000 more Americans were sent in. They will be training Afghans at a lower core level now, and this plan will also involve more air power to protect the Afghan security forces, as well as more special operations forces. We're also hearing about more contributions from NATO, but we don't know exactly how many that involves as well. And we don't know how long Americans will remain there. The White House and the Pentagon will only say this strategy is conditions-based, and it's a more regional approach involving India and Pakistan.
What's changed in how the U.S. has adapted now to fighting ISIS?
The battle against ISIS took a decided turn. The group lost its caliphate in Syria and in Iraq and Mosul. But military officials continue to warn this battle isn't over. In fact, they believe the group will now go underground. They're adopting a more insurgent approach, and that would mean more attacks elsewhere, the attacks like we've seen in Europe. There's also the concern, of course, that the caliphate, when it crumbles, many of those foreign fighters who were there will return to their home countries and launch attacks there. So the battle will change over the next several months.
Cammie, how much of a stunner to the Pentagon was it that Bo Bergdahl was not sentenced to prison for walking off his army base in Afghanistan back in 2009?
Well, there were a lot of strongly held opinions about this. When Bergdahl walked away, he was held captive by the Taliban for 5 years. In the end, his sentencing took over only a few minutes. A military judge ordered him dishonorably discharged, and prosecutors have been seeking 14 years in prison. President Trump called that sentence a total disgrace, and the military judge didn't explain the reasoning for the sentence. The case was very controversial. It even came up in the presidential politics, and that was brought up by his defense. The case was such a lightning rod because of the service members who were wounded during the search for him, and others argued his years in captivity were punishment enough.
Another big story in 2017, the deadly collisions of two Navy ships in the Pacific. What went wrong?
Well, there were ship collisions which killed 17 sailors. There were also a lot of air mishaps involving Navy aircraft and others. But it was the ship collisions that really kicked off a wider investigation into whether this was a systemic problem. And that investigation found simply too few ships doing too much, and that was resulting in fatal errors. There were a lot of commanders relieved after that, and the Navy is now looking closer at adjusting its training, increasing sleep time for sailors. The investigation found the collisions involving the USS John McCain and Fitzgerald were both avoidable.
So that dealt with a safety culture. Meanwhile, the Pentagon also faced another culture scandal, this Marines United saga, where pictures of naked female Marines were shared online. How has the Pentagon responded?
Yeah, some unclothed. We should also point out that some of these photos were of women in uniform, one simply picking up her ammunition. What was particularly concerning were the derogatory comments that were posted under many of these photos, and that was concerning because some of these issues may have been systemic cultural. This was a difficult issue also because of the technology involved. The group kept changing its site as the Marines were investigating this, but it also prompted debate within the Marines and the other branches of the military about whether some of this type of behavior is due to the climate in training, etc.
CBS News national security correspondent Cammie McCormick in studio on the year-end roundup. Be safe, Cammie.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, in the Mideast, attentions turned to President Trump's decision to move the U.S. embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, recognizing that city as the country's capital.
This is a long overdue step to advance the peace process.
Correspondent Seth Doan is there. Seth, what's the fallout been?
The fallout that we saw was the very undiplomatic interactions on the streets. Protests, clashes between Palestinians and Israeli defense forces, the Israeli security forces, rock throwing certainly in Gaza and the West Bank, frustration and anger on the part of Palestinians who feel that the U.S., in essence, unilaterally handed Jerusalem to Israelis.
Staying in that region, Seth, in Syria, you traveled in 2017 to Damascus to report from that city. What's the state of that country?
What was interesting when we were in Damascus, it was a bubble, really. Certainly many people have fled, but there were people still living there in the markets and such. You would go into ice cream shops that would be packed with people having this kind of vanilla ice cream with pistachios that had been crumbled on top. And in many ways, in the center of Damascus, you didn't feel like you were in a war zone, though, of course, there were checkpoints everywhere, a strong military presence. And we were there as guests of the Assad government. They had given us the visa to come in and report, and they had it in their best interest to show the U.S. media wherever possible that where Assad was in power, where he was in control, life continued as normal. And really, some of it was a bit reminiscent of having covered Iraq and been in Iraq when Saddam was in power. There was a degree of security if you were in these government-held areas. We also traveled up to Homs from Damascus, another city there where Assad was continuing to regain power there. But it was on the outskirts of Homs and in parts of Homs where you really just saw the absolute destruction and devastation of so many years of this civil war. Entire neighborhoods just flattened, many of them flattened by Assad's forces. It was interesting, devastating to see how Assad, in effort to root out rebels, had in many ways destroyed his own cities. Of course, the major step forward in Syria from an international perspective was routing out, getting rid of ISIS from Raqqa, their self-declared de facto capital there. That was a major step forward.
Correspondent Seth Doan on the year-end roundup. Stay with us just ahead.
Looking back at some of the shootings that made headlines in 2017.
On the CBS News year-end roundup.
The CBS News weekend roundup after this short break.
Like what you're hearing? Get even more great content from CBS News Radio podcasts. Listen to TV broadcasts like The Evening News and Face the Nation on demand, or hear original audio programming like our weekend review show, The Weekend Roundup. Get politics, policy, and a side of pop culture with White House correspondent Major Garrett on our newest show, The Takeout. Get these podcasts and more from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google Play today.
On the CBS News year-end roundup, a special program recapping 2017. I'm Steve Dorsey. It was a deadly year with mass shootings across the country.
There were a number of high-profile mass shootings in 2017. In October, Stephen Paddock opened fire from a room at the Mandalay Bay Hotel overlooking thousands attending a concert.
All of a sudden, we heard what sounded like fireworks.
It sounded like machine guns going off.
58 people were killed, more than 500 others injured. Shortly afterwards, Paddock killed himself. In November, in Sutherland Springs, Texas.
We always say, it can't happen to us. Well, it did happen.
Devin Patrick Kelly opened fire inside a church. He killed 26. Kelly had previously been found guilty of domestic violence. His name, though, was not put on a watch list, which would have prevented him from legally buying a gun. Elected officials in Washington were also exposed to gun violence. In June, a man opened fire at a Republican congressional baseball practice. House Majority Whip Steve Scalise was seriously wounded but survived. Steve Futterman, CBS News.
Mother Nature also dealt a few tragedies to millions of people. Here's CBS News correspondent Peter King.
An alphabet soup of hurricanes, Harvey, Irma, Maria, walloped Texas, Florida, and Puerto Rico with Old Testament wrath, while wildfires blowtorched California.
Armageddon. It's just gone. Everything's gone.
The toll in lost lives and property, devastating. FEMA Director Brock Long calculated it last month.
We're probably spending about $200 million a day right now just responding to the four disasters.
Outside Houston, rows and rows of cars filled empty fields awaiting new buyers or a trip to the scrap heap.
It's estimated that up to 1 million vehicles were damaged by Harvey.
Much of Puerto Rico is still without power and tourists.
In the long term, it's going to be worse than you think.
For one California wine grower,
the entire 2017 harvest is no longer.
2017, the year that extreme weather got more extreme.
This is like something I thought we'd never experience.
Peter King, CBS News.
CBS News correspondent David Begno has been on the ground reporting on some of the year's biggest disasters. David, let's start with the Southern California wildfires. Describe how devastating those have been.
Well, you hear stories like it's bigger than San Francisco, it's bigger than Atlanta, it's become bigger than Manhattan. I mean, it seems as though every wildfire in California beats whatever record or outlandish statement is made about it. Let me start with the air quality. Air quality might take a back seat to the actual emergency of a fire, but let me tell you, from standing in it, if you didn't have a mask on, you felt like you were eating dirt. According to air quality officials in Southern California, as hazardous as it was, it didn't register as toxic. The air quality was poor, and not only that, but the visibility dropped to one or two car lengths ahead of your vehicle. I mean, that's how bad it was. As for the fire, you know, look, it raged in areas where there were no homes and no structures, and in other places, it became the largest fire to burn in Ventura County. It moved into Santa Barbara County. There were, at one time, more than six fires burning. And I noted at one point, we were on the 101 freeway in Ventura County when a fire broke out alongside the southbound lanes, and I noticed that even though the flames were whipping nearly across the 4th, 3rd, and 2nd lane, the CHP never shut it down. They just moved all the traffic into the far left lane, to the number one lane, and they let traffic continue. And I remember in my reporting saying, true to form in Southern California, they're no stranger to this. Not even wildfires will shut down a California freeway. Now, of course, it did when the Skirball fire broke out and the CHP ended up shutting down both directions of the 405 in Southern California. Listen, that is a nightmare. Okay, when they built a new bridge over the 405 a few years ago, they called it Carmageddon, and they thought that was the worst thing in the world. A fire shut down both directions of the 405. The 405 is a nightmare on a good day. So to have that shut down is just unheard of. A fire behavior specialist said what caused the most recent fires in Southern California was due to weather patterns. He said that over the last several years, usually the months of August, September, and October were filled with rain, and then followed by the Santa Anas. And the rain sort of dwarfed the threat, if you will, when it came to dry vegetation. This year, there was no rain in August, September, and October. So you had the Santa Anas roll in with dry vegetation, and it was perfect fire weather.
There were some hellish scenes in Southern California, but also some pretty bad scenes in Puerto Rico, where you were for weeks covering the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. Tell me what stood out to you while covering that recovery.
First and foremost, the thing that comes to mind is the resilience, the humility, and the patience of the Puerto Rican people. Let me tell you something, Steve. If anybody on the mainland were to lose power for a day, it would be top of news. If people were to be without power for a week, they'd raise hell in high water. Why is it taking so long? Everybody has an answer, and most of them have the same answer. It's an island. It takes a long time to get materials there. For example, I heard from a Department of Homeland Security official recently who said they're having trouble getting enough poles to the island. Believe it or not, the poles that are quite big are tough to load onto ships, tough to find, tough to get there. It seems like everybody has a story about how tough it is, but that's not satisfying the people who have been waiting. Why does power matter? It's more than just a convenience. It is livelihood. You have business owners who are afraid they will have to shut down and close. Okay? You have kids who are studying today in a schoolroom that has no power. So this is more than just, oh yeah, a nicety because I would like to be cool with air conditioning. The sustainability of the island depends on the power. Most of the power is generated in the south, but most of the consumption happens in the north, where most people live. And believe it or not, Hurricane Maria was the perfect storm. It decimated an already dilapidated and delicate power infrastructure. And so rebuilding or repairing has become an incredible task. Now, let me tell you something. The governor of Puerto Rico never requested mutual aid before the storm. And of course, he has his reasons why. He didn't ask for it for more than 30 days, way more than 30 days after. That delayed help getting to the island. I remember talking to the man who led the federal military effort there, Lieutenant General Jeffrey Buchanan. And he said, you know what, David? I could have parachuted soldiers into the island like we did in Baghdad. But he said most of the time when we do that, we're trying to take over a city or secure a bridge. He said we didn't think we needed to, but in hindsight, maybe we should have. That kind of admission in hindsight from a three-star general was fascinating to hear. Because at the end of the day, anybody who tells you that they did the best job they could in Puerto Rico is telling the truth, because that's their opinion. But when you talk to the people on the ground, you'd be hard-pressed to find a majority of Puerto Ricans who are satisfied with the response.
A lot of work ahead to rebuild trust, especially with the federal government. CBS News correspondent David Begno on the year-end roundup. Up next,
looking back at one of the hot-button issues of 2017, fake news.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio. And I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey. And this is the CBS News Year-End Roundup. On the CBS News Year-End Roundup, a special program recapping 2017. I'm Steve Dorsey. Fake news became a real issue in 2017.
Early on,
I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are.
President Trump claimed,
so much of the news is fake.
Some say these are stories deliberately put out by mainstream news organizations. Others say they're disseminated by those pretending to be a news outlet.
The public doesn't believe you people anymore.
CBS's Major Garrett.
A Gallup poll found only 32% of Americans had a great deal or fair amount of trust in the media.
The president's called out those he said were fake news purveyors.
Your organization's
terrible. You are attacking our news organization.
Organization.
Can you give us a chance to ask a question, sir?
From mainstream to social media.
67% of us get some of our news off Facebook, but it is not vetted.
It's a problem for Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg.
I wish I could tell you that we're going to be able to stop all interference. That just wouldn't be realistic.
Congressman Adam Schiff says upgrade technology to cut misinformation.
Searches can be manipulated so that we're seeing what people want us to see rather than the true facts.
CBS's Bob Schieffer says overall,
once this stuff gets out there, it's so hard to knock it down.
Dave Barrett, CBS News.
Let's talk now with CBS News technology consultant Larry Maggot in Silicon Valley. Larry, you're an advocate for finding ways to keep kids safe online. You run the nonprofit ConnectSafely.org. What's the challenge been?
Well, I think the challenge is trying to provide education to young people and their parents so that they can better protect themselves. There are tools out there, filters, monitoring programs, all sorts of parental controls. But at the end of the day, it's really about the kids having software running between their ears and that computer in their brain that will really protect them, not just when they're young, but as they get older as well. And this is especially challenging now, given, first of all, some of poisoning in our culture. I hate to say it, but certain kinds of bullying are on the rise. But also some of the challenges with younger and younger children getting their hands on tablets and smartphones. And the fact that we need to start very early educating children, I wouldn't say exactly from birth, but probably from toddlerhood.
What about keeping, you know, mom and dad safe online and data security? How much of an issue was that in 2017?
Data security was a huge issue in 2017. That was the year where the big Experian hack came out, and as well as information about earlier hacks that had taken place. It affected literally billions of people. So it's a big deal. And not only are there things that we can control, like making sure we have clean machines with good software and up-to-date, things of that matter, but there are things we can't control, like simply being in a database of credit bureaus. We don't have control over that, or the fact that we may have used our credit card at a store. So I think it's up to industry and government to get their act together. But in the meantime, to the extent that we can control our internet safety and our security, we all need to take whatever precautions we can, including things like very hard, tough passwords that you can remember and other people can't guess.
And online privacy. What has been the challenge in knowing who is gathering data on us and how it's being used?
I think that is exactly the point. It's a confusion. We really don't know. Sometimes it's obvious, right? When you go on a web browser and you see an ad for something you shopped for the day before, you know that some kind of cookie or something is passing that information from one site to another. But there's so much that we really have no idea what's happening in terms of our phones and our computers and our tablets. So I think greater transparency is essential. I think that these companies that are collecting information have a responsibility to tell us. I think having tools like private browsers and knowing how to use these tools is important for people who want to protect their privacy. But at the end of the day, if you're going to be part of our society and go online and do banking and shopping and web surfing and all the other things, a certain amount of information about you is likely to get into the hands of those who are providing these services, and then it's up to them to make sure that they don't get into the wrong hands.
CBS News technology consultant Larry Magid in Silicon Valley, thanks for looking back on 2017 with us.
Thanks so much.
Let's turn to transportation now. Late in 2017, Amtrak suffered a disaster in Washington State. Chris Van Cleve is our transportation correspondent. Chris, how does this tragedy stack up against other U.S. train crashes?
Death toll-wise, certainly not the most deadly crash. Obviously, there's a lot more of this investigation to come, but what we know so far is this train was going far faster than it should have been as it approached a curve, and there is technology out there to prevent that situation from happening. It's called positive train control. Congress mandated this technology be installed in all Class 1 railroads after the Metrolink crash in California back in 2008 killed about two dozen people. They gave railroads 7 years to implement it. That should have been the end of 2015. But after intense lobbying, Congress caved and moved the deadline. And so this train didn't have positive train control active. And that very well may have been a factor in this crash.
In the same week, we saw another transportation crisis, the power outage, Chris, at Atlanta's airport. What was the fallout from that?
The immediate fallout was you took the nation's busiest airport offline for about 12 hours during the Christmas holiday travel rush, stranded some 30,000 people at the airport. More than 1,400 flights were canceled over a two-day period, and it's taken days to get things back to normal in that, you know, Delta had hundreds and hundreds of bags just stacked up in baggage claim that have to be delivered to people. So even though the flights are running normally, not everything is where it needs to be.
Another story that generated headlines for days, if not weeks, was that United Airlines passenger who was dragged off a plane. Remind us what happened.
Dr. David Dow had boarded a flight to Kentucky. He was in Chicago. There was a crew that needed to get on that plane, so they needed to make room. And to do that, United started bumping passengers. When it got to Dr. Dow and his wife, he refused to get off the plane, and eventually airport security was called. They forcibly removed him in an incident that was caught on tape. It became the shriek heard around the world for airline passengers, and really it became a rallying cry for a lot of passengers about feeling just mistreated by their airlines. And we saw a number of incidents after Dr. Dow's case where passengers were expressing their frustration at airline employees or calling out airline employees for behaving badly. I mean, just a couple of weeks after that, there was an American Airlines incident with a flight attendant who ripped a stroller away from a mother, and a passenger got in that flight attendant's face, and there was very nearly a fight in the first class cabin on that plane.
Meanwhile, Chris, the TSA continues to face scrutiny over its performance. How's it doing?
If you look at the testing done by the Department of Homeland Security Inspector General, not as good as many people would like. Think back 2 years ago, we got that classified report that leaked that said that screeners missed 95% of items that undercover officers snuck through checkpoints. Well, this time we're hearing it's in the ballpark of at least 70% of the time those undercover officers were able to sneak prohibited items past checkpoints. A little bit of improvement there, but certainly a 30% success rate isn't very good.
CBS News transportation correspondent Chris Van Cleve. Thanks, Chris.
Sure thing.
We have a lot more coming up to remind you of the major events of 2017, including the sexual misconduct scandals that shook the country, on the CBS News Year-End Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
CBS News Radio podcasts are now on Spotify. Listen to great shows like Face the Nation, the CBS News Weekend Roundup, CBS This Morning, and more. They're all from your Spotify app on your iOS or Android device. CBS News Radio on Spotify, the leading global music streaming service, now lets you find the right podcast for every moment. Open Spotify to listen to CBS News Radio podcasts today.
On the CBS News Year-End Roundup, a special program recapping 2017. I'm Steve Dorsey. 2017 may have revealed the Achilles heel for the powerful. Here's CBS News correspondent Deborah Rodriguez.
2017, a year of reckoning over sexual misconduct.
Bill O'Reilly will not be returning to the Fox News Channel.
Scandal on cable TV spread to Hollywood.
They are working to arrest Harvey Weinstein.
From movie moguls to award-winning actors, the mighty did fall.
Oscar winner Kevin Spacey is apologizing to
celebrity chefs.
Shall we drop our pasta?
Like the Chew's Mario Batali stepped aside. Viewers were stunned by the missteps of celebrated newsmen.
CBS News has suspended our co-host Charlie Rose.
Matt Lauer has been terminated.
Careers crashed in the nation's capital.
I will be resigning as a member of the United States Senate.
Al Franken and civil rights icon John Conyers bowed out. Misconduct allegations derailed Roy Moore's bid for Senate, despite an endorsement by the president, who had his own accusers.
I was forcibly kissed by Mr. Trump.
Lawmakers lined up on Capitol Hill for sexual harassment training, and the Silence Breakers became Time's Person of the Year. CBS's Gail King.
I think everybody's sending a very powerful message and encouraging women to speak up. People are listening and they believe you, and that is important.
Deborah Rodriguez, CBS News.
Let's talk with CBS News correspondent Jerika Duncan in New York. Jerika, you've been doing a lot of reporting on this wave of sexual misconduct scandals, including Harvey Weinstein. How has the fallout from these allegations against him shaped Hollywood?
Not only has it shaped Hollywood, but I think it's shaped this country, it's shaped this nation in terms of how we look at sexual assault. It is a reckoning by many people's accounts. It's been a watershed moment. So I think when you look at it kind of from a macro sense, it's not just Hollywood. It's every industry. And, you know, and it's people who have been sexually assaulted in years past saying, I now feel like I have a voice and I don't have to be ashamed.
What was it about the allegations against Harvey Weinstein that you think triggered a response then across so many other industries?
I think, you know, the New York Times came out with their article early October regarding the alleged settlements, the reported settlements that Harvey Weinstein made to women who had alleged that they were sexually assaulted by him. And honestly, you know, from that moment on, it just gained so much momentum. It started a conversation. It started looking at alleged behavior. And then we started seeing women come out with similar stories, almost like a pattern of things that we kept hearing over and over and over again in terms of allegations that Harvey Weinstein would ask these women to give him a massage, allegations that he would parade naked in front of them, allegations that he touched them inappropriately or did things to himself, exposing himself. And again, he has maintained, you know, that he has never done anything in terms of sexual nature that has not been consensual. But we saw so many women come out. I mean, over 60 women within the first 2 or 3 weeks. So I think it was without a doubt a watershed moment because you had so many people coming forward saying it happened to me, too. But then, you know, what we started to see, especially with the social media campaign Me Too, is people coming out who've been sexually assaulted by loved ones, by their, you know, father, stepfather, uncles, aunts, whatever the case may be, and feeling as though this was the time to almost speak out, feeling as though maybe they didn't have a voice before. But we started asking questions, I think, culturally in terms of what that looks like in the workplace. Then you started hearing different stories and allegations about things that were happening, even in our own industry. Obviously, you know, you had the suspension initially and then the firing of our own Charlie Rose, who used to work on CBS This Morning. So I think so many people have had to really take a look inside their workplaces, inside their homes, and address something that impacts millions of people across the country.
How do you think victims are able to cope with going through these experiences and hiding them, essentially, for years, if not decades?
There was always, for the folks that I've spoken to, a feeling of wanting a sense of normalcy. So if that meant blocking it out, if that meant acting as though it never happened, a lot of folks that I've spoken to, at least, will tell you that that's what they had to do in order to survive. It was almost a means of survival. Otherwise, it could break you down literally. And then in some cases, I've interviewed people who said they were suicidal as a result of what they had kept inside for so long. One woman in particular stands out that I spoke to from Cleveland who said she was sexually assaulted by her stepfather and that it happened as early as 12 and it continued until she was about 18. She talked about how she never said anything and had a mental breakdown at 24. So what I hear a lot of times with many of these victims is wanting to make it go away or act as though it didn't happen so they don't speak about it. And then there's the shame that comes with it, the shame that nobody's going to believe you, the shame that you're going to break apart your family, the shame that somebody or, you know, people will start treating you differently. But I think it's great that so many people, men and women, have found a voice in all of this. You know, again, it did start sort of with Hollywood, but it has without a doubt trickled down to, you know, everyday Americans, so to speak, and the bigger issue of sexual assault in this country.
Now that we're having this conversation, though, do you expect things to change?
I think things will change. I really do. And I think not only from the perpetrator point of view, but from the victims. You know, the victims for so long felt like they had to be silent. And I think we're at a point now where there is no shame in opening up and saying this happened to me and then, you know, shaming the person who did it. I just recently went to a book launch for a woman who wrote a children's book. And the children's book is really talking about the language that you need for a child to understand that sexual assault is wrong and what sexual assault is. And I think, again, as we keep advancing the conversation, we keep going deeper. So, again, it may have started with Hollywood, and then we start talking to everyday people who've been open about it on social media. Now we're talking about, okay, who does this impact the most, you know, in terms of the demographic? And a lot of times it's children that are first exposed to this at a very early age. So I think it's great that, you know, these conversations are leading to solutions, are leading to people being more open. But now, you know, again, I'm hearing the conversation turning toward children and equipping them with the knowledge and the language to let people know who violate them, no, you cannot do this, knowing that they need to go tell someone and knowing that that is what should be the norm, not keeping it a secret.
CBS News correspondent Jerika Duncan on how we as a culture and society are dealing with sexual misconduct cases. Thanks for your reporting, Jerika.
Thank you.
If you're not near a radio, use our app called CBS News Radio to find us anytime. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. The year-end roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Dori Valerio is the production assistant in New York. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.